Today on the 21st Show, the past, present, and future of nuclear power and nuclear safety. Many of America's nuclear power stations are well over 40 years old, and there remains public skepticism, even among people who take seriously the threat from fossil fuels and global warming. Meanwhile, the Trump administration has made several moves relating to nuclear security and regulation, firing and rehiring people from the agency that ensures the safety and security of nuclear weapons, and seeking greater control over the regulatory process. My guest to talk about all that is Catherine Huff. She's on the University of Illinois' nuclear engineering faculty, but was also a high-ranking official in the Department of Energy during the Biden administration. I'm Brian Mackey, and that's all coming up today on the 21st Show, which is a production of Illinois Public Media. But first, the news from NPR. From Illinois Public Media, this is the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. And today we're dedicating our entire program to nuclear energy. Some see it as an essential part of our transition away from carbon-based energy sources like gas and oil. Others see an irredeemable and potentially existential threat to humankind, especially when we turn to the subject of nuclear weapons. My guest today has dedicated her working life to some of these topics. Catherine Huff is an associate professor in nuclear, plasma, and radiological engineering at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. She's also director of the Advanced Reactor and Fuel Cycles Laboratory. But Huff took a break from her teaching and research to go into public service, working in the Biden administration's Department of Energy as Assistant Secretary for Nuclear Energy. She returned to Illinois last year. Catherine Huff joins me now in studio in Urbana. Katie, if I may, welcome to the 21st Show.
Thanks so much for having me. Really excited to chat.
So, and listeners, I'll say you can join the conversation by giving us a call at 800-222-9455. Maybe you live near a nuclear facility and have a more urgent personal perspective on some of these questions of safety. Maybe you've been following what's been happening in Washington about nuclear safety and want to talk about that. The number to join us today is 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. All right. I do want to start with kind of news of the day stuff and then get more into the future of nuclear energy a little later in the conversation. It was a different part of the Department of Energy for where you worked, but I wonder what your thoughts were when you first heard about the people fired from the National Nuclear Security Administration.
You know, I'm so glad you asked. I think there are essential workers, and then there are extraordinarily essential workers. There are people who protect us from threats we don't even know are present. And to sort of, without taking a close look, dismiss any of those people, it is a threat to our national security, our safety, and frankly, my comfort with how the federal government is functioning.
Yeah, and maybe by way of background, we should say these are some of the people that, Elon Musk's DOGE, so-called Department of Government Efficiency, fired from this NNSA. What do they do there? What exactly is that? I mean, it's a big agent, or it's a big, there's an entire undersecretary for NNSA, and then a bunch of people who work under that person. What do they do there?
They focus on national nuclear security. That includes everything from securing our nation's nuclear weapons stockpile all the way to making sure that we're, you know, countering threats to nuclear safety, nuclear security, both domestically and abroad. They helped very much in engagements and responses to irresponsible actions by Russia around the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant. Just yesterday was the third anniversary of Russia's attack and seizure of the largest nuclear power plant in Europe, Zaporizhia, and the NNSA team there was extremely helpful during that time in making sure we knew what was happening on the ground and helping us identify options to sort of prepare for any kind of responses if they were going to be necessary.
So I understand a lot of those people were fired, and then there was a round of stories that the firings were rescinded or they were attempted to be rescinded. And yet there are still, I was looking at the org chart for your part of the Department of Energy, and there are still a number of vacancies. Some of them are now marked deferred resignation, which seems to indicate the people who took those Elon Musk's fork in the road offer of continuing to get paid for a few more months. What is your understanding of the current personnel situation in the Department of Energy where you were working just, you know, a year ago at this time?
My understanding is that there have been people who have been let go because perhaps they were probationary employees, which is to say they were in their first year of employment at DOE. From my perspective, that is especially sad because these were some of our most recent and promising hires, people who were beginning their careers in public service in many cases, or were hired to fill really important leadership roles in the beginning. Now, my understanding is that some of those probationary employees that were in leadership roles may not have been fired. My understanding is that a number of people did take the fork in the road. But I think in the context of a hiring freeze, firing people sort of arbitrarily in terms of what position they fill and what role they play is a little short-sighted, because there are most of these positions, I would say the vast, vast majority of these positions are essential for the functioning of the federal government. So to imagine that you'll sort of blanket fire people regardless of what position they fill and task they complete and not have a plan to rehire that skill set, it seems very short-sighted to me.
Hmm. And of course, this is not the only action of the Trump administration that's gotten scrutiny with regard to nuclear energy and nuclear safety. There was a recent executive order that could affect the Nuclear Regulatory Commission's independence. What does that mean for nuclear safety?
Yeah, actually, this executive order released, I think, on February 18th is focused on removing the independence of regulatory agencies across the board in the United States. This executive order doesn't just apply to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. It applies to the FCC, which maybe you guys would be worried about. It applies to the Federal Elections Commission. As a nuclear engineer, I am profoundly worried about what it could mean for the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. And what it says is that agencies like the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, which by law have independence from political whims, will be, according to this executive order, required to clear some of their major regulatory decisions and legal interpretations through the White House Office of the President. That it puts a political influence where it does not belong. It reduces one of the primary principles of good regulation, which is independence. And the reason this matters is that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission focuses on nuclear safety in the United States. Commercial power plants obey regulations set forth by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. They do the inspections at the nuclear power plants across the country. They have all kinds of responsibility with regard to radiation. And to put a political lens on the safety-related, technical, precise decisions that that agency is making is not only foolish, but strongly discouraged by international bodies like the International Atomic Energy Agency, which requires governments to ensure that their regulatory agencies have independence.
I think it's obvious to a lot of observers why the Trump administration wants to exert more control over federal communications policy. We've seen him attacking the media consistently. Do you have a sense of what his interest would be in putting a thumb on the scales of nuclear regulation?
It's hard for me to imagine any president wanting to interfere with this kind of safety decision making. And I can't presume to know the mind of the president, but the consequences and potential consequences are quite clear. When we look at a history of nuclear power accidents, two of the worst nuclear power accidents were in part caused by regulatory capture by the political forces at will. In the case of Chernobyl, the USSR government ignored safety significant concerns around the reactor control rods resulting in the Chernobyl disaster. In the case of Fukushima, regulatory capture in Japan resulted in inadequate responses to new information about seismic risks that, of course, resulted in insufficient emergency planning around the Fukushima plant.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about how, that independence is a part of that, but maybe we should turn then to nuclear development, because that's one of the other things the NRC does. How do these regulatory structures influence the development of nuclear energy in the United States, which has not exactly had a full steam ahead approach for quite a while now?
Yeah, the regulator has the role of making sure that those deployments will be safe. And there's a great deal of conversation right now around how that regulator can build up its ability to be more efficient. And in fact, a very bipartisan act, the ADVANCE Act, was passed last year around how to make sure that the NRC was well-staffed and well-funded and could do more direct hires to support their regulatory engagement, to support a build-out of nuclear energy that we need to reach carbon goals and to ensure plenty of energy for the growing electric demand. The NRC, however, doesn't sort of have a role in advocating for new nuclear. They have a role in regulating the new nuclear that might be built. But the Department of Energy, its sort of separate sister, has a role in advocating for the research and development that will result in innovations and new nuclear. And the Energy Secretary, Chris Wright, has been extremely clear that this is a priority for this administration. It was also a priority for the Biden administration as part of our clean energy activities. And my understanding is that, you know, in 1974, when the Department of Energy and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission were broken apart, it was explicitly to ensure that the advocacy in DOE didn't interfere politically with the safety focus of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. That independence was critical, critical enough to separate these two agencies at their birth.
So what we've talked a little about the Trump executive orders and some of the personnel decisions. I think it's obvious that the Trump administration is sort of fossil fuel focused, I think, when it comes to energy concerns. What do you understand to be so far, or maybe we just don't know yet, sort of the orientation with regard to nuclear energy in particular? I mean, we've seen him put, you know, a professional wrestling leader as the head of the Department of Education. Do we have a sense of where things might be going on the nuclear side of things?
We do. Secretary Chris Wright has been very clear in his very first sort of memo and mission statement to the Department of Energy that nuclear energy, the growth of nuclear energy, are both priorities for this administration. Of course, he also mentioned fossils and his desire to grow a great deal of fossils and really didn't mention renewables at all. So this does give me some concern that the holistic approach to a cleaner energy system goes away if you don't have both renewables and nuclear energy as a part of the solution to, you know, bringing down climate and carbon emissions, you know, climate threatening carbon emissions. I think we have real clarity from his first memo around the desire to see more nuclear built in the United States and some recognition of the Department of Energy's role in nuclear security and nuclear weapons manufacturing. They were a high priority in his first memo.
Yeah. So what response have you seen from the nuclear community to some of these changes in, you know, regulatory oversight, things like that? I know yourself have a guest essay that you've been working on. It's coming out very soon, I understand.
That's right. Yeah. And, you know, former Commissioner Allison McFarland published a really good op-ed in the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists, sort of lining up some of the reasons that I've talked about already, about the concern about the independence of the regulator. The independence of the regulator was mentioned a number of times in a public meeting yesterday about the ADVANCE Act in the NRC. And the industry itself, typically led by NEI, the Nuclear Energy Institute, you know, and others, has real concerns about the uncertainty introduced by a number of different executive orders, not just this one, but also executive orders associated with tariffs that might impact the cost of building a new nuclear power plant, which involves a great deal of steel and concrete and stuff that we might have to import from specialized manufacturers abroad. My understanding is that there is real concern about the uncertainty that that introduces for the price of building these critically necessary new nuclear power plants.
Okay, let me take a moment to reintroduce our conversation. If you're just joining us, this is the 21st Show, and we are speaking with Katie Huff, who is an associate professor in nuclear plasma and radiological engineering. I might shorten that to nuclear engineering as we go on, at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. She was also former assistant secretary for nuclear energy at the U.S. Department of Energy under the Biden administration. That was from 2022 to 2024. I want to talk, we need to take a break in a few minutes, but how did you come to pursue a career in nuclear engineering? Is this something you'd always, what young person doesn't dream of being a nuclear engineer someday?
My parents were both mechanical engineers. And so in a very real way, it was important that the first woman I ever knew was an engineer. It was a clear path to become an engineer. But mostly, I think I have to blame the Richard Rhodes book, The Making of the Atomic Bomb, which really opened my eyes to the history of our understanding of nuclear fission, the amount of science and intellect that went into bringing America to the forefront of nuclear fission and therefore nuclear energy, of course, in the context and the lens of the Manhattan Project. But I really saw that and thought, wow, nuclear engineering seems really fun. Physics seems really fun. I majored in physics at the University of Chicago, where I took a big problems course about the economics of energy and thought, you know, physics is really great, but I think nuclear energy might be a little more impactful today. So I then went to graduate school in the University of Wisconsin and got my PhD in nuclear engineering, largely for those reasons. But I think this is true for a lot of young people, is that nuclear energy poses a chance to help with the climate crisis that we're facing and maybe save the world.
Yeah. I wonder if it matters that you're a little younger than the generation. And I don't know, I think we don't have to say if you don't want, but I'm 48. I certainly remember the day after the day after that movie about nuclear threat. If you, you know, because you had maybe more of your formative educational years after the fall of the Berlin Wall and didn't quite have that sort of same existential threat in the forefront of your mind.
That's right. Yeah, I'm 39. I just turned 39 a few days ago. This does mean that I was born in 1986, right? The year that Chernobyl happened. And so while I was aware of nuclear accidents and, of course, sort of witnessed the aftermath of Fukushima, the sort of foundational existential threat of the nuclear weapon kind of pales in comparison to the foundational existential threat of the climate crisis for many people in sort of my age and especially younger.
Interesting. All right. We are going to take a break on the program. We are speaking with Katie Huff, who is an associate professor in nuclear engineering at the U of I and is a former energy department official under the Biden administration. If you want to join us today, we're going to get to calls in a short time after we come back from a break. 800-222-9455 is the number. That's 800-222-9455. More to come here on The 21st Show. Stay with us. It's The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We are spending the hour today with Katherine Huff, who is a former Assistant Secretary for Nuclear Energy in the United States Department of Energy under the Biden administration and is presently Associate Professor of Nuclear Plasma and Radiological Engineering at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, also Director of the Advanced Reactor and Fuel Cycles Laboratory there. If you want to join us today, 800-222-9455 is the number. We're going to spend a little more time on her background and experiences, especially going to work in the federal government from the academy. And then we'll get into, you know, sort of the history of nuclear energy, where we are today, and where we might be going in the future. So if you want to join that part of the show, 800-222-9455. All right, I want to ask you about becoming an assistant cabinet secretary. Is that a job you apply for? Do you get a phone call with an unknown number from Rehoboth Beach, Delaware, and think it's a prank? How does that actually work in the real world?
Oh, the story is a little embarrassing, but it was February in 2021, and the Biden administration had still not announced their nominee for Assistant Secretary for Nuclear Energy. We were all waiting with bated breath, and I got an email from someone I'd never heard of. His name is Christopher Davis. Said, you know, I'd like to talk to you about leadership in DOE. And I thought, ha, finally, I'm important enough that they're going to ask me who I think should run the Office of Nuclear Energy. So A few days later, I was interviewing for the sort of position of principal deputy and acting assistant secretary. I would later be nominated, et cetera. But it was a complete surprise to me. I had never, you know, prepared for a job in the government. I had never really expressed any interest in taking on public service, which I obviously have always respected, but never really had seen myself in. What an honor, right, to be selected out of a sort of search that the personnel office does for the president. There's no greater honor in my lifetime than that surprise.
I mean, it's on the one hand, there are not that many nuclear engineers in America, but on the other hand, it's got to be a pretty big pool, right? I mean, there's hundreds and hundreds of people who go to your conferences and things like that. Yeah. How is the University of Illinois about this?
Oh, so supportive. And I think actually a lot of universities can learn something from how my department head, our college dean, and the university itself sort of supported my decision to go there. They ensured that my research group, which was large, I had 10 graduate students and a lot of federal funding. They ensured that my research group would be managed by someone with the right expertise. And they did so by promoting a research scientist at NCSA who happened to be a close friend and colleague and collaborator of mine and therefore understood the highly technical, complex, computational multiphysics work that we do in my group. And they enabled her to be a research scientist, take over all of the grants that I was running, and take over some of the advisement of the graduate students so that I could sort of walk away without orphaning all of my graduate students. And then enabled me to come back as I did in May of this past year to my same research group. You'll be pleased to know that research scientist is now a tenured track faculty member at the Oregon State University.
Good to hear. So I went back and watched the final Senate vote on your confirmation. It was weirdly bipartisan for this era that we're in. Talk about what that process was like for you.
Yeah, sure. So, you know, the Senate confirmation process is, you know, pretty invasive. Folks like ask you a lot of questions about your background and make sure that you are the kind of person that should be representing the U.S. federal government.
Is there still stuff about like anti-communist stuff that might be a holdover from the atomic era?
Who knows? I think they learned a lot about who I am from my social media and whatnot. And I think that was sort of new for Senate confirmation. Certainly there were people about my age getting Senate confirmed, but it was one of the first rounds in which people born in 1986 were being Senate confirmed. And I think, you know, having grown up with the internet, it gave a lot of sort of information about who I was. And so I think it was clear to most of the senators where I was coming from, which is nuclear engineering and highly technical background. That gave folks a lot of confidence that I would be approaching things from a sort of nonpartisan lens, at least in the context of nuclear. And I think just generally speaking, the bipartisanship wasn't really so much about me as it was about the popularity of nuclear energy right now. I think because of this critical need for nuclear energy to fight climate change and the sort of traditional support for nuclear energy that the Republican side of the aisle has always had, largely with regard to national security and energy security, those two things combined to have a very bipartisan support for nuclear energy while I was in the office. And I have to say, I think that's largely what happened in my floor vote on the Senate floor, was that nuclear energy was bipartisan, not so much Katie Huff, though I was certainly as polite as possible during my confirmation hearing.
All right. I do want to come back to that bipartisan consensus a little later on. But I first do want to finally ask, as we're continuing to talk about your time as a assistant secretary of energy, I'm going to try and, you know, for our radio listeners, sort of imagine an org chart, right? There's the Secretary of Energy at the top, then you have like a three lines coming down, and you have three undersecretaries, one for kind of national security stuff, one for infrastructure, and then one for innovation. And you are among several assistant secretaries under the undersecretary for innovation. I guess what I'm coming to is as the Richard Scarry books have it, what did you do all day? What does an assistant secretary for nuclear energy do all day?
Gosh, it was different almost every day, but I'll tell you, it started with a briefing of what was going on in the world from my staff, who would get me prepared for any news items in the media, any incidents across the world, anything I needed to be aware of. And then we would proceed to have bilateral meetings with my counterparts across the world, people who oversaw civil nuclear energy in various nations who are our allies, or meetings with companies that wanted to innovate on nuclear energy so that we could hear about what kinds of things the Department of Energy could be doing differently in the area of innovation. Often we spent time working on developing and executing the budgets put forth by Congress. So making sure that Congress has the information that they need to develop their appropriations bills and making sure that when those appropriations bills are put out, that our programs reflect Congress's intent. We spent a lot of time designing the research programs that would result in the work that happens at the National Laboratories in Nuclear Energy. Of course, Idaho National Laboratory was a big area of focus for us because that is the Nuclear Energy National Laboratory. So while the Office of Science oversees many of the national laboratories across the country, the Office of Nuclear Energy oversees one of them, and that is Idaho National Laboratory. And so a lot of my work involved ensuring that I was a good steward of the contract between the U.S. federal government and the contractors that run Idaho National Laboratory. It included a lot of travel. I got to see really cool stuff across the world that our counterparts were doing in nuclear energy research. And the hope, of course, was to bring some of that back to encourage collaboration with those international partners, either on the commercial side or in our national laboratories. And so that was a huge part of my work. Of course, it ended every day quite late in the evening with another briefing of what had happened while I was in meetings all day from my incredibly excellent federal staff.
Yeah, yeah. I bet it seems like you maybe were eager to get back to the lab, though, after all the paperwork. I don't know. Maybe I'm projecting.
No, yeah. I think I was born to be a professor. It's the best job in the world. And while it was a great honor to be assistant secretary, I did feel a pull back here to Urbana, Illinois.
Yeah. All right. So I want to talk about that innovation, but maybe we need to just set the table with a little history of nuclear power. We actually got a question about this from Juno in Champaign, specifically about the history of nuclear energy in Illinois. I mean, Illinois is a big state when it comes to nuclear power. Can you give your sort of 100-level introduction to that?
Absolutely. Illinois maybe is the biggest state with regard to nuclear energy. We have more nuclear reactors than any other state, 11 of them. The majority of our electrons in the grid in Illinois come from nuclear energy. It's almost 80% of our carbon-free energy in Illinois, and nuclear fission was born here. At the University of Chicago, the Manhattan Project created the very first Chicago Pile 1 human-made nuclear chain reaction as a part of the Manhattan Project under Enrico Fermi. That work resulted in what would later become a broad understanding of what fission is and how reactors can be built, how they can be designed and operated. I have my most prized possession is a small piece of that reactor that's in my office. So if anyone wants to come and visit a piece of graphite from CP1, it's right there. It's that important to nuclear energy history that, you know, we really wouldn't be where we are without that experiment. But it also resulted in Argonne National Laboratory, which led in the design of many of the reactors we now call advanced reactors. Argonne National Laboratory, right there outside in the Chicago suburbs, right outside of Chicago, designed the first sodium-cooled fast reactors and high-temperature gas reactors and everything that we now consider sort of at the forefront of nuclear energy commercialization today. And so I think, you know, Illinois, I think, may be the biggest nuclear state.
Yeah. And yet, and we do have a government in Illinois that is pushing for green energy, and yet there are still people who have some reservations about nuclear power here. And we got, I think we have both a text and a call from John in Harvard. So let's go to the phones and maybe we can bring John into the show to ask his question. John, thank you for calling in.
Hey, thank you very much, Katie. It's great to have you on the show. I appreciate you doing this. This is John Kutch from the Thorium Energy Alliance. And my question for you is, now that you're back in Illinois, if you're still doing any political stuff, are you able to bend the ear of Pritzker and his administration to lift this crazily arbitrary 300-megawatt limit for new nuclear and new advanced nuclear? If we want to be an energy state and compete with Texas, that seems to be an own goal, a bad decision, and we all know that it was pushed on him. But That would be my main question. And just this morning, they announced that the Texas spent nuclear fuel storage site court battle is going to go to the Supreme Court. So if you got time, maybe give your comments on that. I'll hold to see what you have to say about Pritzker and his ability to raise or eliminate that arbitrary 300 megawatt limit.
All right. Thank you for that question, John. And maybe I should just provide a little context here, which was the governor had signed a law lifting a three-decade moratorium on all development of nuclear reactors. So I'll take it where you will.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And I think that's the bottom line here for me. And John, you know, maybe it's because I'm an eternal optimist, but I think that that lifting of the moratorium itself, even though it has this 300 megawatt limit, it provides an incredible window of opportunity for small modular reactor developers and micro reactor developers to see Illinois as an option, which it wasn't able to for decades. And I think that that presents some real forward thinking by the governor and the state legislature. You know, I certainly defer to the governor and the state legislature with regard to how they'll move forward and if they ever have an interest in lifting that restriction. But I think at its heart, it's about a kind of public license and public acceptance. And I think the interest in small modular reactors is very strong. And maybe Illinois is the right place to see some new small modular reactors deployed. And, you know, I certainly would support a lifting of the top level, you know, 300 megawatt limit. But I think within the current law, there's an incredible amount of opportunity for smaller reactors.
What is 300 megawatt? Well, how does that compare to like the Clinton power plant or Dresden or a full-on nuclear, what we think of as a traditional nuclear power plant?
Yeah, a traditional nuclear power plant is about 1,000 megawatts. So a 300 megawatt power plant is about 30% of the size. And so it keeps the sort of total power down to a level that's very accommodating for more passive safety systems, and in the event of a sort of off-normal scenario, it keeps the initial decay heat that you have to manage after a shutdown quite low, enabling, you know, natural circulation-related cooling in the event of an accident, managing that decay heat in the long term and avoiding any kind of meltdowns. Now, this is also possible at larger scales, but it is made easier by modularity, and one hopes that the economics might also be better if you can deploy these more like airplanes than airports. By making the construction smaller and more modular, the capital cost and the intensity of the construction project might be a little lower per reactor.
Have you seen movement sort of taking advantage of this end of the moratorium yet?
You know, I hope to see some announcements, but I haven't seen anything specific yet.
Okay. I'm trying to remember, I don't know if John's still with us, what his second question was.
It's about the Supreme Court facing a question about private interim storage for spent nuclear fuel.
Oh, yeah.
My understanding is that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, which understands this topic quite well, has asserted that they have the authority to provide a license to an interim storage facility like the one being proposed in Texas. But that some courts have decided that maybe that's not the case, and it's now proceeding to the Supreme Court to make a final determination. I'm not a lawyer, so I don't know how it'll turn out.
Yeah. How big a problem is that, the idea of what you do with the spent fuel, right? Because, I mean, I'm almost left to remember when Yucca Mountain was a topic of national conversation. A lot of these, a lot of this material, I guess, is just being kept on site now at some of these. So where is this headed? What are the considerations still out there in this? What we do with this toxic, dangerous material.
Yeah, I think it is a really important conversation. It also comes back to social license, and the comfort that people can have around a technology is going to be tightly tied to whether or not you have a plan for its final spent fuel. In the case of nuclear energy, the technical solution is clear. A final repository can be made technically safe. And we've seen, actually, that there are social approaches to finding the right site to that to site that repository. Canada and Finland have both selected final repository sites for their spent nuclear fuel, with communities volunteering to be considered as those sites. Both locations are therefore well accepted by not just the municipality, but also the sort of provincial governments. And that kind of work is the kind of work that a consent-based siting process will undertake in the United States and is undertaking in the Department of Energy.
Okay, let me take a moment to reintroduce our conversation. If you're just joining us, this is The 21st Show. We're speaking with Katie Huff, who is an associate professor in nuclear engineering at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, also a former assistant secretary for nuclear energy at the U.S. Department of Energy. We're going to talk about some of the exciting innovations, or what she's most excited about happening in the world of nuclear power. I also want to talk about some of the concerns people still have, this idea that, you know, we are trying to play God with some of this stuff, and it could be an existential threat to humankind. We're going to reckon with those questions when we return here on The 21st Show. If you want to join us, 800-222-9455 is the number, 800-222-9455. Stay with us. It's The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. Let's continue our conversation with Katherine Huff, associate professor in nuclear engineering at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, former assistant secretary for nuclear energy under the Biden administration. 2021 to 2024, she was in the Department of Energy. Although the first year, I guess you were principal deputy assistant secretary, which is kind of like in waiting while the confirmation process takes forever to play out. All right, 800-222-9455 if you want to join us today. So you mentioned getting to travel the world. What are you most excited about in terms of where nuclear energy technology may be going? I saw a documentary a few years ago. It involved something salt. I don't know. Maybe you can explain it to me like I'm a smart 13-year-old.
Yeah, there's some really exciting advanced reactor technologies out there that are sort of reaching the edge of commercialization. Some of the ones here in the United States that are in process of being deployed include a metal-fueled, metal-cooled reactor called a sodium-cooled fast reactor that's being built in Wyoming by TerraPower, a company supported by Bill Gates. And that reactor is really neat because, you know, it can reach much higher energy neutrons, some higher temperatures. And another sort of neat thing about that project is it's replacing a retiring coal plant there in Wyoming, which I think holds a great deal of promise for the future of nuclear energy. There's also high temperature gas reactors with pebble fuel that has tiny little TRISO particles, tristructural isotropic particles in it to hold the fuel and hold all of the waste products in, all of the fission products in those little tiny particles. These TRISO particle fuels have an opportunity to sort of provide that extra layer of really certain safety, because the coating holding the uranium in, and therefore the fission products, the waste that's radioactive and dangerous once you've run the reactor, those TRISO particles hold in the uranium and the fission products with silicon carbide, which has really high melting temperatures. So you can be assured that there's no radioactive contamination that'll come out in the event of an accident. You mentioned molten salts. One of the innovative reactor technologies that's on the lips of many people is molten salt reactors, which some of them have solid fuels but are cooled by a molten salt, like the Kairos Hermes reactor, which just got a construction permit for their test reactor, or liquid-fueled reactors, where you dissolve the uranium or thorium into the liquid salt and then operate the reactor that way. They're a little further from commercialization, in my opinion, but there's a really excited community around them.
Okay. I heard all those words. I think I kind of can imagine what some of them mean. Big picture, why are these more promising in your view than what we're doing now? Some of our reactors, you know, I looked it up. Clinton, the nuclear power station in Clinton went online in 1987. We have some that date back to the 70s and 60s that are still in operation. It's kind of a remarkable. How much else in the world of technology are we using that is still dates back to, you know, the 1960s? What is different and in your view better about these?
Yeah, a lot is different. You know, I think they build upon a record of safety in the United States by adding new passive safety features, safety features that reduce the number of active pumps or the need for active intervention by a human in the event of an off-normal reactor scenario. This sort of boils down to using physics to control the level of the reaction in sort of all possible scenarios by using new fuels and coolants, you can really double and triple down on some of that safety that's already a, you know, a history of safety in the U.S. I think, you know, that really gives you some promising confidence that the public really responds well to, because you want to feel safe that your electrical systems aren't, you know, creating undue danger for you. And I think, you know, another key feature is that we've had experience with many of these technologies, and some of them are, you know, suitable for higher fluxes and higher temperatures. The higher temperatures are maybe more important. Reaching really high temperatures could be really important for decarbonizing industry. A lot of the use of fossil fuels in the U.S. and around the world is for direct heat applications, whether it's the chemical industry or the steel industry. And we have no hope of replacing that really high quality heat, high temperature heat, with something that doesn't start out as a high temperature heat generator. And high temperature nuclear reactors have that niche covered in a way that pretty much no other clean energy technology, except maybe geothermal.
Are you talking, just to simplify, are you talking about like heating steel at a steel plant or something like that? Or,
yeah, so yeah, the reduction of iron to make steel requires a lot of heat to go into it. A lot of chemical processes require a lot of heat to go into them. And so instead of using the electricity and then turning it into heat, you could start with the heat that's generated by the reactor and not convert it into heat. And you actually get a lot of energy return on investment that way.
Yeah. All right. Let's go to the phones again. Subhash is calling in from Urbana on line three.
Hi. Good morning. I have a question regarding the waste disposal cost of nuclear energy. It's cleaner than most other energy sources we have in the sense of air pollution and other pollution aspects. Nuclear waste has to be stored for tens of thousands of years. How do we include the cost of that into current cost per kilowatt hour and compare that with coal or gas? Or is that included at all in the comparison?
That's a great question. I think economists call this externalities, right?
That's quite right. Thank you, Subhash. This is a great question, and it's got a really interesting history. At the sort of dawn of commercial nuclear power, the U.S. established a standard contract with American nuclear utilities in which they charged a mil per kilowatt hour, so a fraction of a cent per kilowatt hour generated by those nuclear power plants. And they charged those utilities and took that funding in order to establish a fund that would be suitable for a final waste disposal repository, taking on the responsibility of the waste, but requiring the utilities and therefore the ratepayer for the electrons to cover the cost. Now, part of that standard contract was that the United States government would take title to the fuel in 1998, which they did not meet that deadline, quite obviously. And the, you know, after a number of lawsuits, it became clear that the U.S. should stop collecting that fee. And so they actually had sort of stopped collecting that fee in 2013 because the utilities currently are paying to host that fuel on their sites. And so there is a little bit of a question right now, sort of, is the nuclear waste fund sufficient to support the repository? I think it is. But the access to the nuclear waste fund is more critical. That fund, which, you know, tops maybe $40 billion, though there are various estimates on what's in there, that nuclear waste fund is supposed to be dedicated to progress on spent nuclear fuel management, but requires annual appropriations to give the Department of Energy access to it, which isn't a really great structure for planning ahead for a $40 billion project, because Congress could change their mind about the sort of spending. And so one of the recommendations from the Obama era Blue Ribbon Commission on Spent Nuclear Fuel and was specifically to set up a more like quasi-independent agency that would help manage that fund and move forward the nuclear waste strategy. Canada has done this with the NWMO, the Nuclear Waste Management Organization in Canada, to great effect.
All right, let me just take one more moment to remind listeners. This is the 21st show. We're speaking with Katie Huff, a professor in nuclear engineering at the U of I and former assistant secretary for nuclear energy under the Biden administration. As we're coming to the end of our time together, I want to say I've really appreciated having you here. You have a really interesting story. I know there are people listening to us who think, well, why aren't you having someone from the other side on to talk about this? You know, nuclear energy is not clean or green energy to some people. And, you know, there are people who also think it shows a level of hubris that we continue to pursue this technology. And, you know, splitting the atom may yet lead to the end of humankind in one way or another. What do you say to, I'm sure you've heard that from people.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's really important to acknowledge the discomfort that people have with all kinds of technology. And in my field, the discomfort with nuclear technology is very real. It's based in, you know, specific concerns about radiation and public health. And I think...
And real experiences at Chernobyl and Fukushima and,
Absolutely. Not to mention the sort of connotations, though, you know, not really technical connections, but connotations with nuclear weapons, perhaps the worst invention in human history, right? The notion that we, you know, are willing to, you know, risk our lives to gain more power and put more electrons on the grid and stuff, it's very uncomfortable. But what I say to these folks is the following. If you look at the numbers, if you're concerned about safety in nuclear energy, I think the numbers will be very reassuring. Nuclear energy is very, very safe in the United States. And even if you take the whole world picture and you incorporate deaths attributable to Chernobyl and Fukushima and the fuel cycle, the deaths per energy generated, per terawatt hour generated, are actually quite low for nuclear, right alongside wind and solar. And I think only geothermal beats nuclear in terms of deaths per terawatt hour, because there are risks to every technology. And per risk, nuclear energy is generating an incredible amount of power. The sort of concentration and the density of that power is so high that the numbers are such that, you know, it is very safe for the energy being generated. Now, I think the numbers don't work for everyone. And so I think, and a really important piece is to ensure there's a constant conversation. One of the components of a consent-based approach to siting a final repository, or in the U.S. government's case, an interim repository, so that we can buy ourselves a little time to reach a final repository, is to engage the public so that you have informed consent and uncoerced consent for a final repository. And I think those conversations are where real change happens in the minds of folks who have real concerns.
Just a couple of minutes left. What do you see as the biggest... Would you say obstacles, I guess, to expanding the use of nuclear energy as we continue to decarbonize? And you know, maybe we'll all have solar panels on every roof tile someday, but until we get there, it's a long way off. What are the obstacles you see ahead?
I see a couple things. I think right now I'm especially worried about the uncertainty and the costs of certain materials, especially in the context of tariffs. I see concerns for me that those capital costs are already very high. Nuclear power, you have to put a lot of money in ahead of time to build a very complex, precise technical object. The capital costs are very high, so the person building the, you know, utility building that plant has to hold on to a lot of debt for the years before the plant turns on. And that debt, you know, accrues interest. It's very expensive from a capital cost perspective to build a nuclear power plant, even if it will operate for 40, 60, 100 maybe years. You have to do a lot of that payment up front, and the availability of patient capital may be one of our biggest constraints with regard to the promise of building new nuclear power. This is also
patience
compounded.
And capitalism, not two things I think of as going hand in hand.
This is also compounded by delays in construction, which make that problem even worse.
All right. Katherine Huff is an associate professor in, I'm going to say it one more time, nuclear, plasma, and radiological engineering at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. She's also director of the Advanced Reactor and Fuel Cycles Laboratory and a former assistant secretary for nuclear energy in the U.S. Department of Energy under the Biden administration. Katie, fascinating topic. Thank you for being with us today on the 21st show.
Thanks for having me. It's an honor. Love the show.
That is all the time we have for our program today. Coming up tomorrow, we are going to be talking with Illinois U.S. Representative Raja Krishnamoorthy. We'll get his reaction to President Trump's address to Congress, his non-State of the Union speech. And we'll also hear from him about some of the initiatives he's working on and how he is reckoning with Democratic constituent anger over whether Democrats in Washington are doing enough to resist or try and block some of what Elon Musk and President Trump are doing in Washington. That's coming up tomorrow. We'll also revisit my interview with writer Timothy Egan on how 100 years ago the Ku Klux Klan rose to power in the Midwest. His book is called A Fever in the Heartland. That's all coming up tomorrow on The 21st Show, which is produced by Christine Hatfield and Jose Zepeda. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick is our news director. We appreciate hearing from you about our programs and your suggestions for future guests or stories. You can email us. talk@21stshow.org is the address. You can find that and every other way to contact us at our website, 21stshow.org. The 21st Show is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening. We'll talk with you again tomorrow.